Hello and welcome to Fantasy Talks Live, the podcast that came out of the Jose's Amazing World's YouTube channel. Original video recordings of all the episodes in the podcast can be found at Jose's Amazing World's in YouTube. Listeners beware, as plot spoilers can be discussed in any of the episodes in the podcast. And now, without further delay, enjoy the show. We are live. So good morning, good afternoon, good evening, anyone watching live or later at home. It is my absolute pleasure to be joined today by writer and editor at Bam Books, David Pollard. David, thank you very much for being here tonight.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So for anyone watching now or later who may not know who you are, would you mind introducing yourself, please?
It's my favorite subject. It's a big question. So I am a writer. My 18th novel comes out in January next month. If you're looking to read something by me cheap and watching this live, I actually have a book that is right now part of a BookBub promotion. You can get the ebook for 99 cents or the equivalent in any online store. So it's like 70p or whatever, however many euro cents, I don't know. Called the Jupiter Knife. Sorry. I know what the book's called. The Jupiter Knife by DJ Butler and my co-writer Aaron Michael Ritchie is a fantasy novel set in the 1930s about a farmer who uses his traditional magical lore to battle the demons of the Great Depression, on sale right now. So I write mostly for adults, not entirely. I've got a trilogy of novels with Random House for middle grade readers. It's an action fantasy steampunk retelling of the Pinocchio story. Mostly fantasy. I've got some science fiction. I tend to write, generally speaking, fantasy. Also an M editor. For 3 years, I was the acquisitions editor at Wordfire Press, which is a very large indie publisher, headquartered in Colorado. It's owned by Kevin J. Anderson, who's very prolific science fiction fantasy writer. And Rebecca Mesta, his wife. I worked with them for 3 years. And I now am an editor at Bain Books, which is sort of the smallest, arguably, of the traditional publishers of science fiction and fantasy in the U.S. So if you walk into a brick-and-mortar bookstore in the U.S., you'll find Bain Books, and you'll usually find books by me. So some of our bigger named authors, most readers don't necessarily know publishers by name, right? But if you're familiar with David Weber or Lois McMaster Bujold or David Drake, who just actually passed away this week, or Eric Flint or Larry Correa, those are some of our biggest named writers. I also play a little guitar and banjo. And I'm a partner in a corporate training design company, and a lawyer, and an investment banker, and a consultant, and I have three kids and a dog, and I like board games. How about that?
And clearly, you got the same time device that Hermione had on the Harry Potter series to be able to fit all that into your life, right?
Yeah, my great superpower, my great step forward was when I realized I could just be bad at things. I could be bad at stuff, and that's okay.
Oh, dear. All right. So we were talking a little bit briefly off camera before. So writing, editing isn't your first career. Reading on your website and searching your name on the internet, you were a lawyer before.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought I would be a writer from when I was about 7 years old. In fact, I thought I would write fantasy novels. starting when I was seven. My dad was a career academic, and so he would go to conferences and, you know, be gone for 3 or 4 days. And when he came back, he would bring a little gift for everybody, right? And so when I was 7 years old, he brought back a copy of the 25th anniversary Silver Jubilee edition paperback box set of The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit with the Daryl K. Sweet covers. And I basically put myself in the bed and didn't get out until I'd read them. I spent the whole week reading these four books and decided that that's what I was going to do. And I saw myself that way all through my childhood and teenage years, writing stories, telling stories. Then I got to college and I met a girl and wanted to get married, and she didn't want to be poor, and that seemed fair. So I went to law school instead. So I went to law school in New York. I spent 6 years as a kind of a Wall Street lawyer, a securities lawyer. So doing 5 years in London, actually, and a year in New York, working on big deals, big bond issuances, or stock exchange listings or mergers and acquisitions. And then I was an in-house lawyer for 5 years at microchip manufacturers, at Intel and Micron, and an Intel spinoff company. So I'm still a lawyer. I still occasionally do a little bit of that stuff. Still admitted to the New York bar, but mostly I had a full-time legal career for about 11 years. Yeah.
Oh, and then so what was that deep desire to be a writer since childhood that, so to speak, tipped you over the edge?
I wish. it was luck. It was luck. That's not entirely right. So I left Micron to go to this, which is a microchip manufacturer, to go to a spin-off company of Intel. Okay. So Intel took certain kinds of chip manufacturing operations and put them in a new company. And I went to that company. And after about 2 years, we sold it, which was bad because my job went away, but it was good because they paid me some money. So I had a little cash, and I thought I could do for a while basically anything I want, right? What do I want to do? And as a young man, I'd always thought I'd be a writer, and I said, I'll go do that. And so I wrote full time for about 2 years, and that was in space, right, in outer space. If you give an object some propulsion, right, if you push something, it'll just go for a long, long ways, maybe even forever, right? That's not how it looks on Star Wars, but like in real life, that's what happens. And so I spent 2 years writing full time. And that was kind of the push that has really been very powerful in my career since. So I wrote a lot of books in 2010, 2011, 2012 that got published in 2017, 2018, right? The dirty little secret of writing is that most writers don't actually make enough money to live on writing. They live badly. Okay, you can be poor, that's an option. Or they have a job, or they have a partner who has a job, and right, there are lots of ways to do this. So I went back to work. So from 2013, I was back to work full time, doing a lot of stuff. Corporate training for 10 years, legal work on the side, various kinds of consulting, and sort of doggedly continuing to write when I can, as much as possible. And like I said, my 18th novel comes out in January, so I've been able to no one would say I'm prolific, but I'm continuing to be able to publish, and I'm happy about that.
Yeah. So are you of the opinion that writing is a bit like everything else, that the more time you spend doing it, the better you get, and the more natural and easier it becomes to get into that habit of writing regularly rather than waiting for inspiration?
Yeah. There's a lot of things. Boy, there's a lot. That's such a big question. One, I do think that if you wrote yesterday, it's going to be a lot easier to write today. So there's impetus, momentum is a real thing. And, so if you're, I don't know if your audience includes a lot of writers, but
So
a piece of advice, to writers is, man, if you don't have the time to sit down and write for 3 hours today like you planned, because it turns out your dog has to go to the veterinarian, or your car broke down or whatever, boy, if you can sit down and write for 15 minutes, because keep that momentum going is very valuable. That part of what you I think that's baked into what you said. I think there's also a piece in what you said around skill, right? So I do believe that writing is a skill, and I do believe that it gets especially if you're thoughtful, especially if you're trying, right? You want to be learning all the time, even in your own craft, even when you're a master craftsman, right? You're still looking at the works of other master craftsmen and thinking about them and talking to them and saying, well, how did you do this? So this is interesting, right? And sharpening your skills, I think that never stops. And I do think you get more powerful and you develop a wider range and you master habits that make it easier to overcome something like inertia or not feeling inspired. I think that's also true. And also, by the way, apparently I'm very talkative today. I talk a lot. So
it works for me. This is great. This is great. Thank you. Carry on.
Okay. And also, or maybe this is not an and, maybe this is actually a but I do believe in inspiration. I do believe the muse is important. I think this could go a lot of ways. I think you have to respect the muse. I think you have to be the muse in yourself and in other people. Okay. And again, a lot flows from that. I think you have to be looking for sort of the gifts from heaven that are going to give sparkle and meaning to your books. I think you cannot just write what people want to hear, okay? Because the muse doesn't just tell people what they want to hear. The muse has things to say. So if you are just writing what people want to hear, right? If you are just writing to the market, you're writing a kind of pornography, and you're betraying that muse, right? There are other kinds of ways you can betray. This is so important, right? Writing is about being in dialogue with all of the other writers, including writers who have been dead for 5,000 years in some cases, right? You can write a story that is in dialogue with, the tale of the shipwrecked sailor from Middle Kingdom Egypt, or maybe it's New Kingdom Egypt, whatever it is, right? 4,000, 5,000 years ago. Or you can write a book that's in dialogue with Salman Rushdie, right? Who, in his novel from last year, right? So that dialogue's important, but also, you have to respect the muse in yourself, and you have to respect the muse in other people. And that means you have to be in favor of artistic liberty. You have to be in favor of letting people talk and letting them say what they think the muse is telling them to say. And if you don't like them, you don't like what the words are, well, then the answer is that you write a response, you know? That's like a lot of reactions to what you said, but on the one hand, yes, skill and habit absolutely matter. And on the other hand, I do think this is it's not just a business. It's an artistic undertaking and it's a personal journey. And so meaning matters and inspiration matters, and they matter in like a very strange kind of way, right? There's this great Umberto Eco quote from the second printing or maybe the second edition of his novel, The Name of the Rose. Okay. He wrote a postscript, an essay at the end of the novel. And he said a lot of stuff. The two quotes that stick with me are, he says, one, the greatest favor that a writer can do for the audience is to finish the book and then die. Meaning get out of the way. Right? Because the book exists as the book. And if someone's going to interact with the book and she's going to have her own understanding and meaning, and you're not supposed to go say, no, that's not what the book means, right? Your job was to develop your skill, communicate with the muse, and create this artifact. And then her right is to go experience the artifact and think about what it means for her, right? It's not to communicate with you. It's to communicate with the book, which is the other famous quote from that postscript, which is sort of on the same point, as he says that a novel is a machine for generating interpretations, right? So this is a very strange thing, this whole writing books, right? You have to develop skill and be in control, but you also, if you're doing it right, then you're not fully in control. You're creating tools for other people to have their own experiences with meaning in the muse.
I get that. I want to come back to, you're saying so many things that are so interesting, but I want to come back to writing a little bit later, because I'm very interested in your role as an editor. So how did you make that transition into editing? And basically, what does an editor do? What's the job of an editor once a writer has written the book, they found an agent, it lands on your desk? What happens then? What's the story?
Yeah, that's such a good question. And there are there's a lot to say, and different people would probably give different answers. So let me talk a little bit about acquisition and about kinds of editing, and then maybe also about philosophy, right?
I'm game for all of that.
Okay, awesome. And also the market. We could talk about different modes of publishing, and I'm going to try to shift. So like the sun is like, as I said, the sun is coming through the window here. So I'm moving around to try to
light. Don't worry.
So I work with a traditional publisher. The reason I did it is because I wanted to help the publisher. One of the key editors had moved on. They needed somebody. And I also wanted to strengthen my relationship with the publisher. And also, I want to help other writers. This has been an important thing to me in my writing career. I do a lot of things to try to help other writers. This was one of them. So... one of the first things that editors, and editor is a very broad title. Sometimes editor just means a person who works at a publishing company. So you'll see people who have a title editor who don't do any of the things that I'm going to talk about. They do other stuff, but they work at a publisher, and so they get called assistant editor or something else. So acquisitions is the first thing. Someone has to make a decision about should we offer to publish this book, right? Different publishing companies make that decision different ways. A very common way for that to happen at sort of a larger publisher is that an editor is out looking, talking to agents, and going to literary seminars or meeting people at however they do it, reading manuscripts, and then on a regular basis we'll go into a meeting with the rest of the editors and with the publisher and discuss and say, well, I've read two books this quarter that I just think are really great. Here's one, and let's talk about it, and here's the other, and reach a decision collectively. That's pretty common. Bain, that's not quite how we work. There's some aspects to it that are like that, but we're just small enough that the reality is that our publisher and editor-in-chief, Tony Weisskopf, calls the shots. She decides what books are published. So my role is to read them, talk about them with her, make recommendations. I do all those things. And at the end of the day, it's not a vote. Tony will say, well, we're going to publish this one and that one, but not those three, right? So that's acquisition is one thing editors do. Now, the actual editing process, in a traditional publisher, okay, there are said to be four kinds of editing, or four steps or four phases of the edit, okay, by which the book is produced. Now, in reality, these will sort of combine or blend together. It's not always so crisp as first A and then B and then C, right? And again, especially in smaller presses or in an indie situation, and I'll talk a little bit about the indie market in a minute here. So the first phase is the developmental edit. And the developmental edit is the edit that focuses on the story. Okay. And this is the product of the developmental edit is the editor reads it and usually produces an editorial letter for the writer. And the editorial letter will say things like, well, first of all, you've got to give some compliments. You should make sure the writer knows that you like the book, and here are some things specifically I really like about it, right? Because writing is hard and it's awful if people send you comments and they're all negative. So comments on the story, like, I had difficulty feeling a lot of sympathy with the protagonist. I wonder if we could give her a more noble quest, or maybe if her sister got sick right up front instead of later, then she could be, then we would be sympathetic with her effort to, get her sister the medicine she needs. Or maybe we could make the protagonist funnier, and then it'd be easier to be sympathetic or something, right? Or boy, the first act is really slow. I think, the decision Jaime makes after the church is burned on page 200, could we do it at page 100, right? Could we bring that forward? Because it just feels like it takes too long to get there. Or things like that, right? I need more subplots. The climax needs to be bigger. It's an interesting kind of dynamic, right?
So sorry to interrupt you there. So yeah. I'm sure you're about to address it, but like, what kind of, or in your experience, the level of tension between the author's vision of the book and that editorial comment, like how much tension and back and forth is there? And I'm assuming obviously some writers would be easier to work with than others, but is there a degree of tension and interference there?
Yeah, this is exactly where I was going. That's exactly right. And let me connect to my earlier comment, right? So I need to respect the muse in myself by not just writing for the audience, by not pandering, right? But I need to respect the muse in other people too. And it's ultimately the writer's story, right? And so really, what the editorial letter tends to do is say, well, here's where I struggled. And here might be a way to change it to make it easier so I don't, so the reader doesn't struggle. Okay. But the writer might say, I see what you're saying. I'm going to make a different change to try to address the same problem. And in fact, the writer might say, I'm not going to make any change at all. Right. Now, this is where we get into this sort of tricky space, right? Because if I, the editor, send a letter and it says, whoa, I want to, here are five changes I think would really help, or here are five issues and ways I think you can address it. And the writer says, no, I'm not going to do any of them.
Yeah.
So you get into a tricky space, right? Maybe I'll say, wow, you know what? We've paid this person $10,000, but I can't work with someone like on a basis like this. And maybe you call and have a hard conversation and say, we have to be able to work together. Why do you not want to take any of the comments? Right. Or maybe I say, you know what? Never mind. I don't want to publish you.
Hold on. So at that point, this could be a deal breaker, even though maybe the book's been acquired, it's signed, like you said, you've paid in advance. If there's a breakdown with the editor there, that could end with the book not seeing publishing?
It could happen. Yeah, it has happened. I don't want to suggest that it's real common, but it absolutely does happen. And it happens for reasons of story. The editors just really insist the story, they want the story to go a certain direction. The writer says no. It also happens for reasons of politics. I, the editor, object to the political implications of what you're writing. Well, I, the writer, feel very strongly about it. Right. By the way, if you get into a situation, and I have never been, I have never found myself in like this on either side in this conflict, right? But it might, if you got into this sort of a conflict, it might really matter who the writer was and how much leverage the writer had, right? If you're the editor and you give J.K. Rowling some comments, she says, I'm not going to take them. Well, you're going to publish her book anyway.
Yeah.
And she knows it, right? So, also, in traditional publishing, this is one of the functions of an agent, right? And not every agent does this, but a lot of agents do this, where you, the writer, are trying to find your way in, you send your manuscript to an agent. One of the things the agent is going to do is to try to work with you to make sure you're somebody who will cooperate, right? Not necessarily somebody who will submit, who will surrender, but like, can you take criticism? You know, can you respond in a mature way and reasonable way? And can you do a revision? Right. Because you, the agent, don't want to connect your writer to an editor. Hooray, there's a deal. We're all going to make money. And then it blows up because it turns out the writer can't take comments. Right. So there's like a metaphor here. There's a very famous, he's not even a producer. He gets referred to as a music producer. What he owns is a recording studio. He's a guy named Steve Albini. He owns Electric Audio in Chicago. He's recorded some very famous albums, like Nirvana's album In Utero, for example. And he's very famously and vocally has this philosophy that, look, it's not my record, right? It's the band's record. And I am here to try and help the band make the record they want. And that is really how I see, my role as an editor too, is not to impose my will. Like, I don't want to acquire a book and say, well, this is pretty good, but to be really good, you need to put in a dolphin, and it has to be set in a circus, not on a ranch. And also, right, like, I don't want to do that. I want to find a book where I like what the writer thinks and what the writer is saying, and it's a beautiful and it's an entertaining book, and I can help it be all, more of all of those things, right? By helping it be more of what the writer wants. That's, I'm not saying I always succeed in doing that, right? But I'm saying philosophically, that's what I would like to do, is be the guy that helps the writer make the book more of what she wanted, right? So that's the developmental edit. At a big publisher, you might do two or three rounds of that, because the editing process, especially for your first book at a big publisher, might be kind of 2 years long. At a smaller publisher, you might get one, right? You might get one. So that's the developmental edit. Then there is the copy edit, and the copy edit usually is a read through for consistency, right? Did all the characters have the same name all the way through, right? Did they have the same hair color, right? No, nobody mysteriously teleported 50 miles for no reason because the author just forgot where they were, right? Mm-hmm. Or suddenly the gun that was in their hand was no longer there, right? So that's the copy edit. The line edit is someone gets in and looks at the writing on a line by line basis, right? How can I improve this sentence? And again, the goal is not to change every sentence to fit some kind of a Platonic ideal of that sentence, right? But the goal is to just kind of like, oh man, this sentence is really very long. Maybe we work better as two sentences, right? Staying true to the author's voice, right? So again, like over-editing is always a risk. There's always a possibility that you do too much. And the author always has the right to say, no, I don't want this. And in the worst case, the author can walk away. Mm-hmm. So developmental edit, copy edit, line edit, and then proofreading is just looking for mistakes, right? Spelling errors and wrong punctuation. Now, when I read a book to do a developmental edit, I hand over an editorial letter, but I also send over the manuscript, because when I'm reading, if there are spelling errors, I just fix them while I'm in the manuscript. And I will also put comments in there. Like I'll highlight and say, man, you used this word 7 times in the two pages. Or if I notice consistency things, like I won't, there's just no reason to wait for the next person to use them, right? So in real life, those four edits, you know, like they bleed together. But those are the, at least conceptually, those are the stages. Now, by the way, to get back to that point about the sort of conflict between the writer and an editor, which is a real risk. It can happen. It does happen sometimes. Mm-hmm. This is, there's a difference in the market, right? So with traditional publishing, if we, Bain, acquire your novel, right? You have the right to, you can walk away. You can walk out of the contract, but so can we, right? And so we have a certain amount of leverage in that conversation. And so when you say, well, we're not going to change anything, you say, I'm not going to change anything. Well, I can say, well, do you really want to be published? And we can kind of fight that. In the self-published space, the dynamic is not necessarily the same, right? So a self-published author looks at a publisher and says, well, here are all the range of services that a publisher provides, right? These four levels of editing, but also layout and design and, you know, marketing and whatever else, right? And I, the self-published writer, I'm going to go buy things from other people in the market, just service providers, right? I'm going to hire someone to do layout. I'm going to pay an artist. I'm going to hire an editor. But it's really not the same. It's really not the same. And well, So at the most honest end, and I guess I'm just saying this to sort of as a, I'm just putting it out there as a thought for any of your audience that is self-publishing or thinking about self-publishing. Okay. Let's assume that you're dealing with an editor who is scrupulously honest. Okay. And she gives you her editorial, all of her input. That's great, right? But the incentives and the power dynamics are not the same. So you, the writer, well, you just paid her. And you're going to publish the book whether you take her edits or not. So you're not really forced to read the letter and think about it, right? And I think it's actually, I think it's good for a writer to have to sort of confront that, to have somebody who is an intelligent reader and a sophisticated person and has read a lot of books to say, hey, listen, you know, I think the scene with the cheese doesn't work very well, right? And here's why. And so I think it's healthy for a writer to get confronted that way. And so if you hire an editor and she gives you her comment letter, man, do your best to really take it seriously, right? Doesn't mean you have to make those changes. You never do. It's your book, right? But like, go fight with it as if that person was, you know, had power over you. But also at the other end, man, so I worry. I was out doing some market research a few months ago, okay, trying to figure out where indie writers might get some of this kind of help from, okay? And I saw that on Fiverr with two R's .com, right? Where people can sort of post and offer services. And I saw people whose entry said, hey, I have worked with big New York publishers. I worked with Random House or Simon & Schuster, and I will give you a developmental edit of your book for $500. Now, that sounds great, except the price is so low that I am worried that you, the and man, this interview is going all kinds of weird places. I'm worried that you, the writer, right? If you pay $500, like how much time can someone really put in for $500, right? I worry that that person's incentive is not to give you a really detailed, helpful edit. I worry that their incentive is instead to give you a couple of comments based on a very quick read and say, your book is so amazing. This is so great. You're so talented. I wish I was still at Random House. I could acquire this book because it's so wonderful. Now, you, the self-published writer, you get a couple of comments and you feel like, oh yeah, those are correct. And then you feel validated, right? But you just paid $500 for someone to spend an hour looking at your book and sending you a flattering email, right? I worry. I'm not saying I know that happens. Well, I'm just saying.
I think it's a little bit like, I don't know about general audience, but from your background, this is like 2008 and the ratings agencies and yes, all those, you know, CDOs and all that stuff, isn't it?
Correct. This so, looks great. I will take my fee now.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what I worry about.
Is that alignment of interests, isn't it? That in a traditional publishing house,
yeah,
everyone wants to make the best book possible to make the most money possible, isn't it?
Yep.
I think, and obviously, like you mentioned, there will be some friction there, but the interests are aligned. Whereas when you enter a purely transactional relationship, maybe it's in my best interest to tell you what you want to hear, so yes, you come back for repeated business, isn't it?
That's right. And so it's easy for me, right? I'll just easily, oh, this is, I'll pretend I spent a week on it because I'll just sit on it. But, you know, I'll find a couple of easy comments in the first 50 pages. And
yeah.
Right.
So that's a, Does your job as an editor, because let me preface this, I took a writing course a few years ago when I decided I wanted to try my hand at writing. And that sort of messed up for a while my enjoyment of books, because I kept on reading them with my newly trained mindset of looking for things. And as an editor, surely reading for pleasure must be destroyed for you.
Yes, it's also harder to watch movies, because a lot of the same, I don't have any cinematography skill, right? So I never think, oh, that's a terrible shot. They should have placed the camera somewhere else. I wouldn't know, but I know story structure, right? And I go, oh, this is the end of the first act. Oh, yes. Now he set up a subplot there. What's going to happen for the next 20 minutes is he's going to have struggle with the relationship with his son. Oh, yes, there it is, right? That's just one of the prices you pay. So you still enjoy stuff. Maybe your standards are higher. So maybe there's some things you can't enjoy, you know, as much as you used to. Maybe that's always true anyway, right? I for a period of about 10 years, maybe, I didn't read any science fiction or fantasy, and very, very little fiction. In fact, I read, I was in law school. It was more than 10 years. The last couple of years of the university, law school, my first 5 years at the firm, I read very little fiction. I read a lot of nonfiction.
We'll get back to that, because when I was talking to Tim Akers, he told me that I should get you talking about history. So it's one of my points for later on. So
okay, I'm up for it. So I went back, at the age of like 31 or something, and I said, I'll tell you what did it actually. So Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings films, okay, the first one came out, and I went and reread the Lord of the Rings, which I had read 6 or 7 times, right, as a kid. This was the thing that started everything for me, and I reread it. And I said, "Oh yeah, this is amazing. This is wonderful." Like that, right? And like any really good book, you see more, right? Having come back to it, you go, "Oh, I understand more than I did before." Like it's richer, it's bigger, it's deeper. And I said, "Okay, so I'm going to go back and reread a bunch of the books that I liked when I was a kid," and I did, and some of them held up. And someone did not.
Right. Could you, if you don't want to give your opinion, if you don't want to get involved, it's fine.
Okay.
But this is a personal pet hate of mine.
Okay.
Have you read The Wheel of Time?
I read book one, basically. Right. Okay.
Because it's my opinion that book series needed a good editor with a big pair of scissors and just, but I don't know, if you've only read book one, then I don't know, what's your take on the subject before we move on to the next bit?
I've heard this comment from others, right? Like, I think that, is it book 8 where it goes back and it shows the same half hour of time that he's shown before from different perspectives, and that's all the book is? This is kind of the thing I was talking about before, right? Where at a certain point, the financial incentives, the writer has so much financial power that unless the writer is deliberately willing to say, "I am going to be humble, and that will cost me more work, and it will cost me ego, but there will be a better book as a result," that what you're going to get is probably worse books.
Yeah. Okay. And let's leave it at that. I understand. So, kind of coupled together, because like I said, when I was doing a bit of background research on your good self, I was very pleasantly surprised. I always like to have in my TBR list some sort of short story anthology collection there, because I think they're nice to read in between bigger books. And so two things. Whatever happened to the short story as a medium? Is it because there's no magazines anymore? And what brought about Space Eldritch? And if you want to talk about that, that's fine, because it's the first book I'm going to buy next year. So go on.
It's because there aren't magazines anymore. That's basically it. There are still lots of ways to publish short stories, but they basically, the number of venues that are paying enough money that a writer could make a living are basically not very many, right? And so what is professional rate? So in the US kind of market, you talk about professional rate being something like 7 to 10 cents a word. So again, if I write a short story every single day, right? A 5,000 word short story every single day. I'm not a super fast writer. I'm a pretty fast writer. That's like 5 solid hours of writing. And if I sold it for 10 cents a word, right? Every single day, $500, $500 a day. You could make an okay living, right? You need to be sort of careful about where you lived and right and not having too big a family and stuff, but that's if you wrote and sold a story every single day. You'd have to be like insanely prolific and insanely successful, right? So people used to be able to make a living selling short stories, and they can't. There are still lots of places to publish them. There are some, Space Eldritch is an example. There are some ways of publishing short stories that I think are basically new with the publishing revolution. So I'll come back and talk about that in a minute. The magazines that remain, they still exist, right? Are now facing a new challenge. Which is, I'm sure you've read about this. People are using AIs, right? Chatbots to write and short stories, right? And I can't remember, I can't remember which venue it was in February, shut down because they'd become inundated with so many AI created short stories. They were spending all their time just trying to detect the short stories, right? Where people just said to ChatGPT, write me a 5,000 word short story about a guy named Gus who, is trying to find his robot teddy bear or whatever, and take that and submit it. Yeah, short fiction is tough. The publishing revolution, by which I mean companies like Amazon, but not only Amazon, right? The means of publishing a book has become very democratized. It's very cheap. Same as the like it's like it's very analogous to the what's happened in the music industry. Like the technology and the tools necessary to record a record are within the grasp of very ordinary people, right? You don't have to get Abbey Road studios anymore. You can go get a for a few hundred bucks, you can go get a recording unit that will record 32 tracks, and you and your buddies can do it in somebody's basement, right? You can publish a book the same way. Amazon makes it basically, it requires time, but the combination of Amazon's tools and free graphic software, like something like GIMP, for example, mean that you basically, if you have a computer, that's all you need. You can create a book and make it available for purchase. And so that's created in the short story space, that's created new. So that and websites have created new places, new venues for publishing. And so Space Eldritch was an example where an editor named Nathan Shoemate had an idea, which was he had this idea which was Lovecraftian horror in space. And he didn't want to actually edit anybody. So he went and he recruited writers, and the specific criterion by which he chose writers was people whose work I believe I will not have to edit. They'll turn in work that just I'll proofread it and that's all. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to have to say, change the story this way. I'll just fix spelling mistakes. And I was very lucky that he invited me. He had read one unpublished manuscript. In fact, he was at that point the only person who had read my fantasy novel, Witchy Eye. He read it in manuscript and said, okay, be in this anthology. And the way it worked is, or works, it still exists, is there was no advance. There was no company to pay in advance. Nathan did, so there's a cover artist. Nathan did the design and the proofreading and put the book in order. So the editorial work that there was, and everybody else wrote a story. And like doing any of those things got you a share. And then whatever the sales were, we just share the sales. And Nathan might have like a double share because he's got ongoing administrative tasks, right? He has to collect the money from Amazon and send out payments and stuff. I've written short stories in a lot of anthologies that are basically put together more or less on exactly that basis, right? Now, maybe it's we'll pay you $25 or $50 up front and then also a share or something, right? But there's a market of perfectly respectable, right? There is a point of view from traditional publishing that says, oh, if you're not paying professional rates, you're a scam. That might be true, but it isn't necessarily. There are a lot of people in the indie space with perfectly goodwill who are not ripping anybody off, who are operating on this kind of a basis where it's more like a cooperative, right? We're going to produce this together, and then we're going to share the benefit together, right? Or smaller publishers who are operating on a very small budget, and so they operate at a similar basis, right? Look, I can only pay you $25, but you will get royalties, and so if we sell a lot, you will make money. And I've got stories in collections where, in fact, I have made kind of a fair amount of money because it turned out to you know, the anthology went and sold a lot of copies. So there are opportunities out there now still to publish short stories. It's not really print magazines anymore very much, right? I don't know if Playboy still publishes stories, or the New Yorker probably does, right? I don't know, but I think not as many as there used to be. And I think you basically have to look at it not as a way to make a living, but as a way to do something else. And that something else might be purely to make art, which I respect very much, or it might be, you know, in conjunction with my career writing novels, I'm going to write short stories, you know, that have an auxiliary function that contribute toward the novel writing success.
Yeah. No, I get that. And I just found sort of the relevance of H.P. Lovecraft even to this day. I think it's become a little bit trendy of late to be very critical of H.P. Lovecraft or to belittle, I think, his contribution. But I think it's undeniable. I think his impact has, you know, withstood time and has influenced pretty much every single horror writer out there, isn't it? And the fact that you have taken it into that sort of outer space, I am really curious to see what I find there.
Yeah, he's so interesting for so many reasons. You know, like absolutely, his influence is enormous, right? And it's interesting to kind of look at it and say, well, what is it? There's an aesthetic, right? And some of that aesthetic is just really driven by the time, but also the idiosyncratic individual this guy was, right? Like on some level, it seems, for example, that H.P. Lovecraft was just disgusted by fish, right? And so fish are always like a creepy, horrifying presence, right? There's never anything good that looks like a fish in an H.P. Lovecraft story, right?
Well, that came out of the sea. Yeah,
it came out of the sea. If it comes out of the sea, it's horrifying and alien, right? So he didn't like, you know, fish and octopus and eels and stuff. And you're right. I think there's criticism of him. I think one of the big things is we live in an age, and I don't want to project the American culture war on the whole world, right? That's an easy mistake for an American to do. But in American publishing, we've had a couple of waves of sort of very political and anachronistic judgments being applied to writers, living and dead, right? But hey, this writer who died 85 years ago didn't have my politics, or didn't, you know, believe things that I think are racist specifically, right? By my standards, he was a racist. No one should read his books, and no one should respect the contribution he made, right? And that this gets back to my earlier comment. I mean, it's a bigger thing. You just can't, if you are really a writer, right, and you are serving the muse, you never tell anybody to shut up. Anybody, living or dead, that's not how you do this. You can say, I disagree. And if you feel that Shadow over Innsmouth or whatever was racist, then the proper response for a writer is to write a story back that argues, right? But it's not to say we can't publish him. We're no longer going to name awards after him. He was just bad, right?
I mean, I agree with you, and this is going to be leading into my next talking point. But I discovered Lovecraft still in my teens, and I think his racist views were very subtle in his writing. I think they were more prominent in his private letters that got published posthumously. But in his writing, you sort of kind of have to look for it, and they totally passed me by when I read it as a 15, 16-year-old. But even so, I am the parent of two mixed-race kids. I would never stop them from reading H.P. Lovecraft. I would love it if they picked up his works and read them, because I think they are fantastic. Right. So leading into your interest in history, I think you are of the opinion that we cannot judge things in the past with the lens of today, isn't it? I think context is always important.
I think it is. I think also... It is a political act and a foolish one to try to erase the past. I think the responsible way to interact with the past is to learn from it, and the basic thing we do to learn from it is read the writings from and about the past, right? So censoring those, reducing them to a single dimension, making every person or every issue about my personal, you know, political crusade is a bad way to be human. It exposes us to being manipulated. It reduces the wisdom that we have in our culture and our personal lives, right? And Lovecraft is so interesting. He, among other things, right? He died poor and obscure, right? And he his fame, his literary, well, it depends on how you define success, right? But reaching a large audience, the part of success that is reaching large, happened after he was dead, right? And it happened in ways he could not possibly have imagined, such as, for example, the popularity of the tabletop role-playing game Call of Cthulhu. He could not possibly, this is how I met him too, he could not possibly have imagined that was going to be a thing.
That people I still play every Tuesday night.
Yeah, that's what a fun game. That's how I encountered H.P. Lovecraft is, and then I went and read the stories, right? But those didn't exist. Tabletop role playing games were not a thing when he died in 1938, whatever the year was, right? So somehow his investing in his relationship, and there's like a lesson for writers who are listening here too, right? His investing in his relationship of mentoring and writing correspondence and trying to help younger writers meant that when he died, that he had champions who were still alive, who wanted to write like him, who wanted to write stories using his creatures, who wanted to make sure his stuff stayed in print. And then somehow, you know, he got into movies by Guillermo del Toro, and he got into he got into episodes of the Ghostbusters cartoon, and you can buy little plush Cthulhus, which is bizarre, yeah. Right? Because his whole there's like the aesthetic piece, fish are scary, and there's like the linguistic piece where he'll use words that are archaic in colloquial English, right? Like squamos or rugos or right. But like arguably the basic thing that was just amazing was the cosmic horror, right? What was scary was not that a monster jumped out and said boo. It's that you slowly face the realization that you are nothing.
Yeah.
And your species is nothing. You are not the center of the universe. You are no different from an ant, and things are inevitably going to come. They're going to wipe you and your species out, and no one will care, right? And it's the horror of that void, and right? And he nurtured younger writers who were around to champion him later, but also B, this is the, again, to connect to an earlier point, this is what literature is all about, right? Is he had a dialogue forward. He engaged in, and people are now having dialogue back with him, right? what a wonderful enterprise literature would be.
And talk about an editor's role there, because as much as he was criticized later on for what he did to the mythos, August Derleth is responsible for that continuing of, you know, he founded Arkham House to carry on publishing Lovecraft's work.
Right.
And if it wasn't for him, he probably would have just, you know, stayed as a footnote in literary history, isn't it?
Yep. People would have written their scholarly articles about this writer everyone has forgotten, but you wouldn't be able to get on Amazon and buy Cuddly Cthulhu or Cthulhu Bobbleheads or Cthulhu for President, Why Vote for the Lesser of Two Evils bumper
sticker. That's right.
Right?
Yeah.
What an amazing and sort of interesting case to think about.
And so then, like I said, so Tim Akers said, I should get you talking about history. I gathered you've got an interest in history, and you've made references to it. And is that what influenced your writing of The City of Saints?
Oh, yeah. That's a good question.
Thank you.
Well, these are all good questions. You've obviously done this before.
I honestly don't know what I'm doing. I've been praised for my relaxed approach to it, but my only defense is that I don't know what I'm doing. I just throw questions out there, and I hope that I get someone engaging like you, where I can just listen and learn. I honestly, this is, for me, this is a privilege. So, yeah, thank you.
Well, awesome. I'm thrilled to be here. So City of the Saints comes from or has a root in another book. So the British explorer and writer and swordsman and linguist Richard Burton. Okay, so not the actor, Captain Richard Francis Burton, was a super interesting guy. He was in the East India Company as a young man, right? And he loved languages. I think the company paid you a bonus if you learned a local language. And he discovered that he had facility for it. So he just started learning kind of all the local languages. And went on to have this really sort of varied career. He famously went on an expedition to discover the sources of the Nile. While he was up there, he had a spear shoved through his head. He had scars on his cheeks from where the spear point like went
right
through his mouth. He was a swordsman. He was awarded an international fencing medal for inventing a fencing maneuver. He wrote histories of the sword. I think he wrote, I'm going to get this wrong, but I think it's something like 80 books. He went on the pilgrimage to Mecca. He was not Muslim. He was British. He was at least part Irish gypsy, Irish traveler. He was at least nominally Christian. I don't know how Christian he was in terms of actual devotion, but he went on the pilgrimage to Mecca. He didn't convert. He disguised himself as an Afghan doctor, so he knew in Arabic he'd have a recognizable accent, but if he spoke, I can't remember what it was, Pathan or whatever the language it was, he figured the Arabs wouldn't realize he was speaking with an accent, right? So he went as an Afghan doctor, and at the age of 30, he had himself circumcised to do this because he figured people were going to see him urinate on the road, and if he wasn't circumcised, they might decide to kill him, right? So he was a tough, interesting character. By the way, after his death, his wife famously burned. He translated, he was first to translate the 1001 Nights, the Arabian Nights into English. And as I remember, I think in his translation, all of the naughty bits are there, but they're in Latin. Put them in Latin, in footnotes at the bottom of the text. But he translated, and I'm forgetting what it was, but he translated some Eastern erotic text. It wasn't the Kama Sutra, but something kind of
along those lines,
like that. Yeah. And when he died, his widow Isabel burned a bunch of his papers, so we don't really know what that was. But in 1859 he went to Salt Lake City. Salt Lake, this was not part of the United States. Or it was unorganized territory. It had only been acquired from Mexico about 12 years earlier. The Mormon settlers had only moved out there right about exactly when the U.S. acquired it, actually. When they left, it was Mexico. When they arrived, it was the United States. And they were very scandalous, right? People thought the Mormons were wild and dangerous, and in fact they appear with a lot of the same stereotyped language that the American press and the British press used to talk about the Middle East, right? So very kind of oriental descriptions,
right?
And probably not accidentally, because the Mormons were polygamists. So there was this idea that they had like wild harems and stuff. And so Burton went to go see. And he wrote a book, and it's called The City of the Saints. And it's a super interesting book because this guy, right, Burton, he went to the sources of the Nile. He had himself circumcised and went on the Hajj to Mecca. You could not shock this man, right? And so he wrote his very sober account of all the people he talked to and the conversations he had. And it's a very interesting, just observer's account. This was the sort of beginning of the great age of travel literature. So like Jules Verne's novels that are, they're all travel books. They're all books about travel.
Yeah.
Mark Twain writes Roughing It and Around the World in 80 Days, right? That like the world is becoming smaller and so people are go on voyages and write books. And so he writes this book. It's super interesting. It's very just sober and factual. I'm from Utah. And so it's fun to read him talking about, rumors that weren't true or things that were true or his impressions of people or sitting there talking to old Eve Hanks about how to avoid getting robbed by bandits on the road to Carson City kind of stuff. But I was reading that, and this was during those, it was during that period when for kind of 3 years I was writing full time and I had just finished Witchy Eye and I was trying to figure out what should I write next. And I was reading this book and I thought, wow, you know what? This should be a steampunk adventure novel. This is a cool piece of nonfiction. It would be even cooler as an over the top kind of crazy steampunk adventure novel. And so, so I stole the title. So Burton's book is called The City of the Saints. City of the Saints is my title. It's set in 1859. Burton is one of the characters. And he is traveling west as an agent of Her Majesty Queen Victoria, because there are rumors that the wild Mormon kingdom has airships and ray guns. And everybody wants to get control of that or get access to that technology, especially because it seems like war is about to break out in the between this the northern and the southern states. And he's traveling. He has competitors. Steampunk has not only steampunk, but maybe especially steampunk literature has a tradition of borrowing real historic people and especially writers. It's kind of a
James Blaylock uses Conan Doyle in his series. That's right.
Yep, absolutely. Samuel Clemens, Mark Twain is one of Burton's competitors. So Burton is a writer. Samuel Clemens is too. He's traveling west on his amphibious steam truck, the Jim Smiley. He's an agent for the U.S. Army. He's traveling with this sort of homicidal lunatic he can barely keep under control. Edgar Allan Poe, who in the real world had been dead about 10 years at this point, died a very strange death. Possibly killed as a side effect of election fraud. But in the story he's alive and he's faked his death and he's in disguise as an exhibitor of Egyptian antiquities. And so he's got like a canister of flesh-eating mechanical scarab beetles and he's got an ultrasonic whistle that commands a sort of mechanical attack dog. And they're all converging to try to get control of airship and phlogiston gun. So this is a scientific dead end, right? There was this idea that phlogiston was a substance inside matter, and that when something burned, right? If I burned this box, what happened is the phlogiston was being consumed and it left behind calx. That is actually nonsense. But in the book, it's real. So there's a phlogiston right. gun, and it ignites things. So I turned Burton's very sober travel book into a over the top gonzo action romp with like kung fu heroines and ray guns and crashing airships and stuff. So history, yes, but sort of as the pretext or as the starting point for writing what is really just meant to be a fun action adventure story.
That is fantastic. That's brilliant stuff. The book I will never write, but since I found out this fact, it's been going around in my head, is that Agatha Christie, there's a period of her life where she disappeared for like a few days and no one knows where she was, and she just turned up like 5 days later. So in my head, there's a story there. There's a story there where she's, you know, some sort of time traveler, secret agent, meeting H.P. Lovecraft, possibly fighting some kind of, you know, dark horror, something. There's a story there, but I don't think I'll ever get to write it. But, you know, you can take that for free if you think there's anything in there.
Why not? That sounds like a great story. You should write it.
No. I think I work better as a reader than a writer. Like you said, I've got a couple of books on Amazon because, you know, everyone can these days. But once kids came along, my life just took a turn for other things.
I understand how that is. You'll get your time back, though.
Yeah. I just got a few years still to wait for that.
That's probably right.
But I quite like those pseudo-historical stories. I think Tim Powers does a great job with his pseudo-history. And the thing I admire, of course, like love-hate relationship with Tim Powers' books, but the fact that he respects utterly and down to a T the timeline and where the characters were at a particular point in time, I think he's, I think in particular, Declare is a brilliant book.
Yeah. Declare is fabulous. He's one of the ones. So when I was young, I read The Drawing of the Dark, and that was all I could find by him. And this was pre-internet, of course, you know, and I couldn't find, the library system didn't have anything else. And so I just thought, well, one hit wonder, I guess. But when I came back, you know, 20 years later and was like rereading the books I'd read as a kid, I read that one. And this was good. This was really good. I was right to think this was good. Then I went and read the rest, you know, and Declare is like a John le Carré novel done as a fantasy. But yeah, his thing is to scrupulously respect the real history, right? And so all the strange details about his father insisting that Kim Philby never be baptized, for example, right, are real. Have you read Tim's most recent one, My Brother's Keeper? No, her Brother's Keeper.
No, I read he did this trilogy of these two mm-hmm. sort of paranormal investigators.
Yeah, Vickery and Castine. It's kind of like...
Yes, that's right. So I didn't read the first one, but I read books 2 and 3, and I wasn't enamored by them.
Mm-hmm.
So like I said, it's an author that I've got like something like 10 of his books or something like that. Mm-hmm. And you go like, for someone that I don't like so much, I seem to have a lot of his books. But I think I've got like a deep desire to really like his works. I've read Last Call a couple of times. Anubis Gates I've got there as well, and so on. And on Stranger Tides. But I always find that he cheats me with the magic. I never understand his magic system. And I feel like I need a bit of explanation there. But this is my thing.
So you might look at his most recent one. I think it's called Her Brother's Keeper. I really should know because I edited it. It might be My Brother's Keeper. I think it's Her Brother's Keeper.
Oh, sorry. So I am a bit disparaging of Tim Powers.
No, not at all. Well, I understand. The Vickery and Castine books are
are almost like someone else wrote them, right? Because sort of the thing that like is classically a Tim Powers book is that like history.
Yeah.
And there is some of that in those books, but not as much. And they're more kind of about UFOs and crop circles.
That's right. Right? That's right.
So Her Brother's Keeper is a fantasy, and it's set in early 1800s, and it's on the English moors, and it's about a family with a curse, and it's about a sect of one-eyed werewolf hunters who are themselves former werewolves, who to stop themselves from changing shape, they have to poke out one of their eyes, and like a ghost dog, and an ancient temple to Minerva, and the main character is Emily Bronte, and it's all about the Bronte sisters and their useless brother Bramwell and their father, and it's full of, and I interviewed Tim about this, it's full of all those kinds of really weird real world details that in fact no one can explain in real life. So the father, Patrick Bronte, every morning got up, loaded a pistol, and fired it over the graveyard, and no one knows why he did that, right? And there's just like 50 details like that go into this very cool kind of gothic fantasy novel. So it's sort of, I don't want to say I don't like the helicopter novels or whatever, but like for me, Tim's like most stuff that I have liked the most has had that kind of historical tie.
Yeah.
And maybe even the tie to writers, right? Like The Stress of Her Regard is one of my favorites.
Yeah. I've read that one as well. I think he works better in that sort of Victorian setting than with the whole LA movie Hollywood scene, like earthquake weather and things like that. But yeah. Like I said, for an author that I don't love, I seem to have a lot of his books. So
that's funny.
It's a funny. I really want to like him.
Yeah.
But I always find something that I don't understand, something that doesn't make sense to me in terms of, there's always ghosts in his books. There's always a ghost.
Yeah.
But it doesn't seem to be considered, or people seem to know things about ghosts and how to work around them or how to deal with them. But we never know where that knowledge comes from. We as the reader, we don't go through. I suppose in fantasy, there's always an element, particularly, I blame Brandon Sanderson for this, that in all his books, you get an exposition section of the book where he has to explain the magic system to the reader. So you do it through the eyes of the main character. Tim Powers never does that. He never gives you an exposition dump on his magic or the ghosts or anything. You just go along with the ride, which obviously helps the pace of the book. But I feel like I am missing something that is never there.
That's so interesting. Yeah, I think that is something that Brandon Sanderson has done to fantasy. I think the pendulum has to move back. I was at a panel about 3 years ago, 2 years ago, at a Comic-Con, and the panel was basically an argument about hard magic, and it was me against six other people. They were wrong. And a guy in the audience raised his hand and he said, the question to me, he said, so, okay, I don't understand though. If I don't have a hard magic system, then what's the reveal at the end of the story? And I said, are you telling me you think that the only way to end a fantasy novel is to learn something about the magic system? I said, this is Brandon Sanderson has taught you this. That's ridiculous. You don't have to learn anything. But if you want something to be learned, it can be,
who committed the crime, or, you know, what is the consequence of this action, or, you know, what do we find in that previously unexplored land, or any, a million other things. It does not have to be, oh, and it turns out that if I put steel and tin together and burn them both, then I can make it, right? So like the financial success of Brandon Sanderson, I think, has a distorting effect on what, and I'm not saying you're victim of this, okay? But I've seen it. It has a distorting effect on what people think fantasy literature is about. And it's not just this guy. I have for years, people find out that I'm involved in fantasy literature, that I write and edit it. And they think when they're pitching their novel, okay, I'm writing a novel, here's my magic system. And I say, stop.
Yeah.
I don't care about your magic system. Skip forward to the next part. And they, I don't know what to say now. Right. Or they'll ask me, I say, yeah, I write fantasy. This is my fantasy series. Which, yeah. What's your magic system? That's not the important part of the story.
Yeah, no. I agree. I mean, and luckily, you know, I discovered fantasy way back before Sanderson, and I never had an issue with a wizard casting fireballs when the time called for it.
Because with Gandalf, right? And Gandalf never explains Jack.
That's right. That's right. And that's not the issue. That's not the problem. And I was fine. I say I was fine. I think with Sanderson, I think he's guilty a little bit in the Stormlight Archive and Brent Weeks to a degree in his Lightbringer series, that they come up with these hard magic systems that are codified and ruled and so on, but they still find a way to break the rules so the main character can do something that has never been done before within the constraints of that magic system to get out of a sticky situation. And it's like, well, then you've defeated your own purpose on creating this. This thing, but maybe I'm being too harsh with that judgment, but I find that.
No, this is, so we're at the edge of a very big conversation about which I have some very definite views. Let me spell out at a high level, kind of what I think about this stuff. Okay. And there are lots of people who like hard magic, and I don't object to the so-called hard magic stories or systems existing. But I think it is, those are stories that walk away from the essential power of fantasy literature. They're AWOL. They have abandoned the post. Why? Well, you get into the question of, well, what is fantasy? Okay. It, on some level, the difference between fantasy and science fiction is that in fantasy, the hero has a sword, and in science fiction, the hero has a ray gun, right? And that may be, you know, if you're picking what shelf the book goes on, maybe that's all the thought that goes into it. Oh, she has a bow and is riding a horse, fantasy. Oh, this guy is in a spaceship, science fiction. But I think that the genres are distinguished from each other and from other genres at a philosophical level, at a level of like, what is this genre trying to do? And there are different ways to talk about this, but I think that the philosophical heart of the fantasy genre is that it is a spiritual genre. It is wrestling with the what if questions about the human spirit, okay? And you can think about that as being the unconscious mind, okay? Or you can think about that as being, you know, the right brain. The left brain is what I can consciously focus on, but the right brain is the part of me that's making all of the connections that I don't see, right? Mm-hmm. So fantasy is exploring that to understand more about human beings. It's trying to explore the archetypes. It's trying to explore ideas about God, and it's putting right. And I think all of these are different ways to say the same thing, but we may be more comfortable with some formulations than others. Okay. Fantasy at its heart is a literature that's trying to do that. What are the tools for exploring the unconscious mind, for exploring you know, the human, the sort of the human heart, the human relationship with ideas about God and the soul, right? Well, one of the big ones is magic, okay? Magic lies right in that space where it's very hard to define what it is. There's a lot of academic literature arguing about what is it anyway, right? And it's very close to the unconscious mind, and it's close to anthropology, and it's close to angels and devils and goddesses and gods. And so fantasy literature gets in there with ideas of magic and uses analogy and wonder and archetype to try to teach us new things about the spiritual state of humankind, who we are, how we really think, what are true and surprising insights in the universe around us, right? So when you turn your back on real magic and you create something else, right? You're, again, there are different ways to talk about this. You're choosing, rather than exploring all of the complex unseen connections that are in your right brain, and you're looking through the focus of your left brain at a construct you yourself have created, right? If I use this color, I can get bigger, and I touch that color, I get strong. If I burn tin, I can jump. If I burn copper, I can see farther, right?
Mm-hmm.
You have thrown away a bunch of your tools, and what you have is arguably not fantasy anymore. It's just an adventure story, people on horses, right? And like another way to kind of think about this is there's a genealogy, and again, it's actually not even clear where it starts, but somewhere back in the mists of time, when we're like cavemen squatting around making cave paintings and eating our neighbors, right? Ritual and mythology and unconscious images, and we start to make art, and fantasy literature, fairy story, epics all descend right out of that matrix, right? And then below fantasy literature is games, Dungeons and Dragons,
yeah,
Magic the Gathering, and below those games is hard magic, because hard magic says I don't want to deal with the weird dark cannibals in the caves. I don't want to think about the legends and the epic stuff. I'm just going to reduce real world. I'm going to replace real world magic and wonder and analogy with a game system. Right? It's like Magic the Gathering. If I have two red glass beads and this card, I can
do
this attack. And it, again, I warned you, I have feelings about this.
Right? No. Everyone
agrees with me, but I think that it's a pernicious influence on the size of Brandon Sanderson.
I call
pernicious influence on fantasy literature.
No, because I call hard magic systems, it's not magic, it's performance enhancing drugs. They, you know, I take this substance, like you said, I can jump higher, run faster, see further. But there's no sense of wonder. It's not magic. It really isn't. It's just performance enhancing drugs. And then you got someone like Brian McLellan, who basically in the Gunpowder Mage trilogy, they snort gunpowder and they can shoot more accurately. It's like, right. It's all the same thing, you know. The only hard magic system I really enjoyed was Brent Weeks in the Lightbringer series.
Mm.
But a good magic system doesn't make necessarily, it doesn't make a good story. It doesn't make better characters. It doesn't make better plot. It's an interesting feature, but it's not the meat of the story.
100%. If there are writers who are watching this and who are feel like, oh, Dave is wrong, I like hard magic systems, you can like hard magic systems. Please don't make your story be about the magic system, because then it's nothing. Make your story be about people. And, you know, if you like having a hard magic system, great. Don't submit it to me because I won't acquire it.
There you go.
Someone else.
So one final question. And I don't know but if you've edited his books, but because you've talked about kind of distinguishing science fiction and fantasy, and an author that seems to struggle the two genres I'm currently reading is Christopher Rocchio.
With the
Sun Eater series. I'm currently reading book 5 in the series. And I've read very little science fiction, but it doesn't strike me as that what he's writing is science fiction. Yes, it's in a space opera, but there are some heavy classical fantasy elements in there. And I would find it hard to categorize. And just because it happens in space, and like you say, they got ray guns and they fly a spaceship, doesn't necessarily mean it's a sci-fi series.
So this is excellent. I'm glad you're reading it. So I don't know, maybe you know this, but I actually edited his book 6. So book 6, Disquiet Gods, comes out in April. I edited that one too.
So I knew he had moved across to Ben, because the reason we're talking basically is this, I should be ashamed here. Someone that used to work at Ben earlier this year saw my videos and my discussions of the Sun Eater series.
Oh yeah.
And they offered to add me to your e-arcs.
Awesome.
And I was like, great joke, you know, go away. And it was like, no, for real. Like, you know, I work at, so like I had a look on later, like, oh my God, this person is who they say they are. Like, you know, their email address and everything. So it's like 3 books. Like, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Not complaining. To this day, I have not received a single e-arc yet.
Oh.
But I don't care, because I got to talk to Tim. I got to talk to you. And it's opened up a whole different sort of avenue in my channel that I wasn't counting on. And I'm loving it.
Yeah.
So, you know, dream scenario, I get to talk to Christopher at some point when I finish the series. But I'm not asking for it. I'm just saying I'm reading his books. And that's why we're talking today, is through his series.
I can absolutely hook you up with Christopher. That's not a problem. I edited book 6. I love the perception you are sharing. That is, I believe, absolutely correct. It wears all of the clothing of science fiction, right? The high matter blades and faster than light travel and, you know, space combat. There's a sequence, you know, which book are you in? Book 5, did you say?
Book 5, Ashes of Man. Yeah.
Yeah. So you've already is it book 2 where we meet Karn, right?
And yeah, that's right.
His kind of dead planet with the sort of strange, weird cancerous beings and. It wears all the clothing of science fiction, but you are right. It is a fantasy series. It is absolutely about the things that fantasy novels are about. It is about the human spirit. It is about, in a very real way, it is about putting that spirit back into science fiction. Right, putting the ghost back in the machine, spiritualizing a universe that has spaceships and faster than light travel, and there's a lot of things to say about that. What I want to do though is I want to let you talk to Christopher rather than me say too much.
But I will say that is, yeah, he is, Christopher is infuriatingly young. He just turned 30 this year, which which is wonderful because he might write 50 more books like this.
Yes, that's right.
And he is, he's really the heir of Gene Wolfe, in terms of writing big, big idea, speculative fiction novels. What do I want to say here? I will say this. There's a surprising number, I think, of Christopher's readers who miss what is going on a fundamental level in the story. And I think I think you have to realize that it is it's actually not just that it's fantasy, which it is, and that it's explicitly wrestling with kind of spiritual ideas, but also that it's very explicitly a Christian and a Catholic book, like Gene Wolfe, like Tolkien, right? And so I think that is a great perception. I am absolutely going to connect you with Christopher. Not only did I edit book 6, but he came to my house for my writing retreat last spring. I've spent a lot of time with him. That is an easy connection for me to make. I could probably get Tim Powers too, actually, if you're interested to.
Okay. I'm so excited. I'm gonna have to go and take a pee right now because that'll be utterly amazing, and I'll be eternally grateful. And if you ever came to this part of the world, a traditional Spanish paella in its hometown, it's on me, if you ever visited.
Wonderful. It's a deal.
Fantastic. Yeah, I mean, someone like Tim Powers, who I started reading when I was 15, 16, it would be amazing, even though, unfortunately, the thing with what I do, this channel, I say what I think. I'm not trying to gain followers. I'm not trying to get, free books. I'm not trying. This is my hobby. This is because, like I said to you, I live in a small town in the east coast of Spain. No one in my circle reads the books that I read. There's no one I can talk to. So I started this thing when I moved back here 4 years ago. And then it's connected me to people all over the world. And it's allowed me to engage in a hobby and a passion that I've had since I was a kid. The fact that I'm talking to you tonight, it's amazing. The fact that I talked to Tim, all the authors, indie authors I've talked to, it's a bonus. But, I'm not looking forward to become a booktuber and give up the day job and this is what I'm going to do for a living. This is, it's a passion of mine. And it will go as far as it will go, whatever that is.
Yeah.
And the reason I'm saying this is because I would say what I think. I don't feel beholden to game. If I have a negative review about a book, I would say so. If there's something I don't like, I would say so. I'm not trying to please anyone.
I respect that a lot.
But just to reiterate, if I could talk to Tim or Christopher at some point, that'll be like Christmas and my birthday all wrapped into one parcel.
Awesome. I'm happy to connect you with both those guys and any other Bane writers. I think I could probably get any of them to talk to you. So
really appreciate that.
Happy to do it.
Thank you. I think on that bombshell, literally, I think this is a good time to leave it here for today. Before we go, though, David, could you tell us where people can find you or what you're up to these days?
Yeah. So again, if you think, okay, I'm not so totally offended by Dave, maybe I'm willing to try a book. And if you're listening to this anytime in the next 8 or 9 days, you could get The Jupiter Knife by DJ Butler for 99 cents, or the equivalent on any ebook outlet. My website is davidjohnbutler.com. That's John, J-O-H-N, davidjohnbutler.com. I'm pretty active on Twitter. I still call it Twitter. I think we're supposed to call it X now or something. I don't know.
Apparently.
Yeah. My handle there is at David John Butler. I used to have a very large Facebook following, but I deleted that account a few years ago. So that's basically it. Twitter, the website. If you're in Discord and active and message me, I'll invite you to my Discord server, which is pretty, pretty lively. I can be emailed through my website. I always respond.
Excellent. Well, once again, David, thank you ever so much for accepting the invite today. And for anyone who's watching now or later on, thank you for popping in, everyone. Take lots and lots of care. Merry Christmas. And we'll see you soon. Bye.
Bye.
And hopefully now we've got the